talking about the Fermi theory this morning, and including some of its why we want to go beyond. And then, if time permits, I'll actually get started on the standard electroweak model. So as we saw yesterday, the Fermi theory is an effective 4.4 fermion interaction that successfully describes things like muon decay and actually many other processes. And it is simply an interaction Hamiltonian that involves four fermions interacting at a point. Actually, it's written as a product of two currents. And each current takes one fermion into a different one, a different electric charge. So this is called weak charge current because it changes, it's a non-diagonal, it changes charge. And this is different from things we've seen in QCD, in which the electric charge in QCD, a gluon could change the color, but it never changed an up quark into a down quark, for example. I described the form of the leptonic part of the current, which is vector minus axial vector. That means it acts on left-handed electrons and right-handed positrons. These are actually not independent. These are basically the CP conjugates of each other. Which is basically Hermitian adjoint. If you have a left-handed electron, I haven't gone through the formalism of that, but you can never separate these two. Similarly, for the left-handed neutrino and right-handed antineutrino, these are just Hermitian conjugates of each other. So if you've got this one, that's just the adjoint, basically, up to some gamma matrices. Yes, sir? No, I said CP conjugate. Antiparticle would take E minus left into E plus left. Parity takes left into right. CP takes E minus left into E plus right. And that is basically the same as just taking the Hermitian conjugate. So you can never, you always have the two together. And they're actually just the two components of a vial spinner. This is true whether or not CP is a symmetry of nature. You've always got the two, even if there's some violation of CP. On the other hand, right-handed electron, which is related to left-handed positron by CP or by dagger, same thing again, by adjoint operation, this is a separate vial spinner. It's completely mathematically independent to begin with. And the weak interactions don't seem to care about this. That's an experimental fact, which is implemented by the fact that there's this V minus A form, and which is basically, in modern language, means that the weak interactions are chiral. They distinguish between left and right. Yes?
So if neutrinos didn't have masses,
yeah,
and they were actually chiral,
yeah, the antineutrino is right-handed and the neutrino is left-handed. That's a two-component vial spinner. That is what we call normally the neutrino and the antineutrino. And but they're not charge conjugates. People get very confused about that. Even experienced physicists get confused. They're not charge conjugates. They're CP conjugates. And the original standard model with no neutrino mass did not even introduce a right-handed neutrino. I'm going to. But to tell you the truth, we don't know for certain whether there is a right-handed neutrino in nature, even in 2014, because you can actually, but let me not get into the question of neutrino mass yet. Okay, so yesterday I did not write down the form of the hadronic current. So one might try. Since we want to be able to describe beta decay, one might try to define a hadronic charge ranging current to be P bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 n. And that would be, you know, your first guess. However, there's a problem with this, and that is that there's really lots and lots of weak transitions involving hadrons. There's lots and lots of hadrons, and there's lots of transitions. For example, there's a decay pi plus goes to mu plus nu mu. So you'd really have to have some sort of additional term that would involve the pi plus field. And since it has, you might try to write something involving, for example, a derivative of a pi plus that is part of the current. But then there's other decays involving kaons and strange hyperons, and there are all kinds of things going on. So one would have to keep adding more and more terms to these currents. And so prior to the quark model, that's people assumed that they would have to do that. They concentrated more on how these currents transformed under SU3 transformations and things like that. In the modern, however, so this is probably not the way to go. So let's go to the quark idea. In terms of quarks, things might be simpler. So one might try to write that the charge raising current is U bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 d. And actually, this is a pretty good approximation to what actually happens, but it doesn't quite work. The reason it doesn't quite work is twofold. Is first of all, the rates for beta decay are experimentally only about 95% of the rates for mu decay. When I say the rate is the same, what I mean is the kinematics are different, the phase space is different, et cetera, et cetera. After you correct for all of that and just try to pull out the actual amplitude squared, the part that's independent of kinematics, et cetera, turns out that the beta decay rates are 5% smaller. Secondly, this is what we call, these are what we call delta S equals zero transitions, whether described this way or this way. And delta, let me finish the sentence. S is strangeness, remember, and the strangeness is zero for all of these particles, so there's no change in the strangeness. Yes, you had a question.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could just elaborate on how the difference in rates shows that that current's not possible.
It'll become clear.
Okay.
Yeah. And this current is possible, it just has to be modified a little bit. And that's what I'm getting to. Now, so that was the first problem with this. And you know, if this were truly the current and if that were truly the Hamiltonian, then the rates should be identical. By rate, again, I mean amplitude squared after I stripped out, corrected for any corrections from strong interactions, any corrections for masses and kinematics, et cetera. That's what I mean by the rate right now. Secondly, there are strangeness-changing transitions observed in weak interactions. Remember, I introduced those strange particles and said that the strong interactions conserve strangeness and that they would be stable. Some of them would be stable with respect to strong interactions, and they only decay under weak interactions, which are much slower. But examples of this would be K plus goes to mu plus nu mu. And or K plus goes to pi 0 mu plus nu mu. Or sigma minus goes to neutron, antineutron, antineutrino. I mean, there's lots and lots of them that are observed. And these are ones in which you're starting out with a strangeness of minus one in each case, and going to a final state with strangeness zero. A strangeness of plus one here and strangeness minus one. So there are observed weak interaction transitions that violate strangeness that cause these particles to actually decay. And these have rates that are about 5% of mu decay rate. Again, after correcting for all the phase space and so forth. And perhaps I've written it in a slightly suggestive way, 95% plus 5% here. Now let me, to make this, if I simply had this for my current, that's not really accommodated in any way because it doesn't know anything about strange quarks the way I've written it. Okay, so let me now review something about SU3 symmetry. I wrote down the picture. I'm just going to write the one for the baryons. This is the proton. This is the neutron, sigma minus, sigma zero, also the lambda, sigma plus, and then the cascades. And these are the ones with strangeness zero, strangeness minus one, strangeness minus two. Maybe I'll write the one for the kaon also, just for completeness. K plus, K zero, the pi plus, pi minus, and eta. Pi zero and eta and pi minus, and then here is the k minus and the k zero bar. So these were these octets, these weight diagrams for SU3, and this had strangeness of plus one, strangeness of zero, strangeness minus one. And finally, let me write down the quarks, which are triplet under SU3, U, D, and S. And this has strangeness zero, strangeness minus one. Okay, those first transitions, the delta S equals zero, which are almost but not quite the same strength as the leptonic transitions, they involve transitions such as this. These are the delta S equal zero transitions. And there are the weak interactions. We observe transitions in like that along those arrows whenever it's kinematically possible. The strangeness changing transitions that we observe, first of all, they have a property that was observed empirically. These all satisfy delta S equals delta Q. That is, the difference between the initial and final strangeness is the same as the difference between the initial and final charge, electric charge. And I'm only considering the hadrons here. Total charge with the leptons is conserved, of course. So for K plus goes to mu plus nu mu, we have delta S equals minus one. By delta S, I mean initial minus final. This was S equals 1, S equals 0. And delta Q is minus 1, because we're going from plus 1 to 0 in the hadronic charge. Similarly, for sigma minus goes to neutron plus E minus nu E. The strangeness, the initial strangeness is minus 1, the final is 0, so delta S equals plus 1, and the charge is plus 1. So lots of transitions satisfying the so-called delta S equals delta Q rule were observed. And what was surprising to some people was this was an empirical rule, and there were other transitions, such as sigma plus goes to proton, goes to neutron, E plus nu E was not observed. And a transition like this would have been delta S equals plus 1, delta Q equals minus 1. This would have been delta S equals minus delta Q. And it seems this is plausible, but it was never observed. And similarly, transitions such as sigma plus goes to neutron, E plus E minus. This would be called a weak neutral current. This one would involve delta S equals plus 1 and delta Q equals 0. It's neutral because there's no change in, the proton. There's no change in the hadronic electric charge. People looked for things like this, and this was not observed. So it was only these delta S equals 0 and delta S equals delta Q that were observed. Now, that was a sort of, empirical, but it's hard to understand systematically until SU3 came along. And on SU3 level, the delta S equals delta Q transitions are ones that go this way. On the quark diagram, they go like this. Now, would we have expected something like this? Well, if you don't know about SU3 or quarks, it seems very analogous to the other one. But if you look at it on this weight diagram, a delta S equals, let's see how many. That would have involved a transition like this. And although one could have such a thing in principle, it obviously looks quite different from the SU3 octet perspective. You can go along these lines just by acting with one of the elements of the Lie algebra directly, acting once on one of these states. You can go these directions or these directions. And you could not get from here to here with an infinitesimal SU3 transformation with a single action of the generator. You could get there with a finite rotation, but there's no generator that takes you directly from here to here. The Fijk, if you looked at it, that would take you from here to here is 0. So somehow, and it's the same picture here, and there's nothing like that at the quark level. You can't even draw anything like that from the quark point of view. So somehow, these weak hadronic currents seem to be aligned somehow with some of the generators of the SU3 Flavr group. The delta, this last one, this weak neutral current, it's actually called sometimes the strangeness changing or flavor changing neutral current or strangeness changing neutral current. That would have corresponded to a transition like this, in which electric charge is not changed, but strangeness is. That doesn't seem to exist. Now, that's not justified from what I just said about SU3, because that would be a direction of an SU3 generator. But that doesn't happen to exist. So we still don't have a perfect understanding of what's going on. But at least I hope that this diagram sort of systematizes what was observed. Okay, all of this was put together in a nice explanation by Kabibel in the early 1960s. I forgot the actual year. And it was this was written not in a quark language, but in a sort of abstract hadronic language. But it's much easier to see what the Kabibel rotation is if I write it in the quark language. Kabibel hypothesized in the quark language, however, rewriting in quark language, that the hadronic current is u bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 d prime, not d, d prime. Now, you know in quantum mechanics, you can have superpositions of quantum states. And d prime is simply a quantum superposition of d and s. D prime is a linear combination, a rotation actually, of the down quark and the s quark. And the theta c is an angle that we now call the Kabibel angle. And it has a numerical value, sine theta Kabibel is around 0.23. That's an experimental fact. Do not get this confused by the accident that another angle that we'll introduce in the standard model has a sine squared of about 0.23. That's just a coincidence. So this field, or the corresponding state, is a rotation of the down and strange. And Kabibel hypothesized, so this would be u bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 d with a coefficient cosine theta c plus sine theta c u bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 s. This current drives the delta s equals 0 transitions. It will be suppressed compared to the leptonic currents by cosine squared theta c, which is about 5%, 0.95 roughly. And this current drives the delta s equals delta q. And it leads to a rate proportional to sine squared of theta c, which is about 5%. And that neatly accommodates all the systematics. So this was the Kabibel hypothesis. And in terms of this hypothesis, one can nicely correlate all of the strangeness changing and strangeness non-changing decays, the sigma decays, the kaon decays, and all of the other ones. And it involves this rotation that maybe it looks ad hoc. It is. But it shouldn't be too surprising, because in quantum mechanics, one has this kind of thing very frequently, just mixing of states. It represents a mismatch, in some sense, between the strong and weak interactions. The weak interactions conserve strangeness, and sort of the natural states there are the down and strange, or the pi and the k, or the proton and the sigma, and strangeness has never changed. The weak interactions, those are not the natural states. D prime, and it's the orthogonal one. One can also define S prime as just the orthogonal combination. This one doesn't enter. But you can, it's still a state. It just doesn't enter the weak current. For the weak interactions, these are the sort of natural states. So there's some mismatch between them. And that's going to turn out to be associated in the quark picture with the fact that the down and strange quarks are the ones, are the mass eigenstates, the one, like the energy eigenstates, the one that have definite mass. But there's some mismatch between that and the weak interactions. Okay, any questions? Yes?
Yep. So what's the significance of the flavor eigenstates in terms of the QCD group theory?
The QCD group theory acts on the D and S. So a QCD transition would take D alpha into D beta, where these are color indices, and S alpha into S beta. So QCD preserves color. And again, it's a mismatch. Let me just write the what's called Kabibel universality. Weak universality is just the hypothesis that the strength of the leptonic processes, which has a coefficient G Fermi, amplitude squared, should be the same as the strength of semi-leptonic processes that has amplitude G Fermi squared. I mean, they're the same. We didn't put different coefficients up on top. So universality, which is not exactly true, is modified by Kabibel. And what we really have is G Fermi squared. This is the leptonic strength, like mu decay. That's the strength measured in mu decay after stripping off the kinematics. And this is equal to G Fermi squared cosine squared theta c. This is the beta decay, or the strength measured in the delta S equals zero processes, plus G Fermi squared sine squared theta c. This is the strength measured in the strangeness changing processes. So we still have a universality. Leptonic strength is the same as hadronic strength, but in this rotated form, you really have to take both into account, and then universality is preserved. So that's the Kabibel theory. Okay, any questions? And this current, this Kabibel current, has the same stuff is the leptonic. It violates parity maximally. It violates charge conjugation maximally. It's consistent with CP invariance. It is CP invariant. And let me make a remark at this point, and I'll make the remark again later, but it's worth making more than once. We still, to actually calculate a semi-leptonic process, we'll have to take matrix elements of that hadronic current involving quarks between physical hadron states, such as the neutron and proton, or the pi plus and the vacuum. And those are matrix elements in which strong interactions play a role. And sometimes one can't calculate them from first principles because they're modified greatly by strong interactions. They're bound state effects. Sometimes one can calculate them just using things like isospin symmetry. But the remark I want to make at this point is that when one calculates the matrix elements, say, of between two hadronic states of say, the vector current. You've got a vector current, that's the gamma mu, and an axial current, which is the gamma mu, gamma phi. When you're calculating these matrix elements, one can make use of reflection or parity invariance and charge conjugation invariance. The reason is these are just strong interaction effects. And any weak interactions would be a second order effect. So in other words, by writing it as V minus A, maybe I'll write it this way. I've already, to leading order into weak interactions, just the fact I've written it this way, I've taken into account the parity violation and the charge conjugation invariance. And then if I want to actually calculate this, let's just look at the first piece. Sometimes I can simplify, I can make progress in calculating this because I know this is a vector and these strong interactions conserve parity. So weak interactions, parity violating effects would only come in second order. So. Okay, let me give, I'm just going to give a couple examples of this stuff. Let's consider the charge pion decay. It decays into mu plus and nu sub mu, which is called pi mu 2 decay. It's just a label for it. This decays this way 99.99% of the time. And it decays into e plus nu e, called pi e2, 1.24 times 10 to the minus 4 is the fraction of decays like this. So it's basically the rest. It has a very rare decay, E plus nu E pi 0, which is called pi E3. And this is 1.036 times 10 to the minus 8 is the fraction. This is called pion beta decay sometimes. And these rare decays are very important because they're measured and they're tested, but I don't want to go off onto that. Incidentally, the pi zero decays into two photons, and that's an electromagnetic decay. Okay, let's consider, I'm just going to consider this one and this one. The pi plus goes to mu plus nu mu, which has a Feynman diagram, if you will. Let q be the pion momentum, and this is the mu minus. Call that P2, and this is the nu sub mu. I'll call that pi plus, and this is the, I actually wrote, in my notes I did it this way. Let me do it this one. So this is pi minus, this is mu minus, and this is anti-mu neutrino. And the matrix element for this is just, well, it's minus I mu minus nu mu times the Hamiltonian interaction density. So I have to calculate this matrix element. And the leptonic, this involves the leptonic and hadronic currents. And clearly, the leptonic part just factorizes from the hadronic part. So the leptonic part, after pulling out this, is just the u bar for the muon, and that's gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 times the v spinner for the anti-neutrino. But I'm still stuck with the matrix element of the hadronic current. Currents are actually at a space-time point, but after pulling out the energy momentum conservation, it's just evaluated at space-time point zero. So I need the matrix element between the pi minus state and the vacuum of this J, of this current. And okay, so now I seem to be stuck because how do I calculate this? Well, the answer is I can't. or at least I couldn't until about 7 or 8 years ago. As of 7 or 8, this is a strong interaction problem. This is because here, think about it, this is somehow describing the JH. The relevant part of this is cosine theta cabibo times the d bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 u. So did I get this? I guess it was, yeah. So it's u bar gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5d. So in some sense, this is, you can think of this sort of pictorially like pi minus and then some strong interaction blob. And this, you can think of, this is the current that involves a an up and a down quark with a transition between them, or d and a U. Here's the current acting, and in some sense, you have to see the matrix element of the up and down quark with the pi minus. So this, it's like a wave function, a bound state wave function. Only this is not non-relativistic quantum mechanics. This is relativistic quantum field theory, and it's very difficult to calculate such things. We now can calculate it with lattice techniques pretty well, but we couldn't before. Okay, but one can still make a lot of progress on this calculation by using symmetries. The first thing we can do is we can say that this matrix element has a Lorentz index. So it has to be, whatever this is, it has to be proportional to a Lorentz 4 vector. There's only one Lorentz, there's only one 4 vector in the problem. That's the 4 momentum of the pion. So this has to be proportional to Q mu. Let me pull out a minus I cosine cabibo, because that was in the current, and it'll turn out that the rest is real. Has to be Q sub mu. And then there's this some number. And I'm going to call that number f pi, which is going to be called the pion decay constant for obvious reasons. So although I can't really calculate this, it's I know it's I can calculate it up to one unknown number. Q squared, it's on, well, Q squared, you say? You could. If you allowed pi minus to be off shell, then this could be a function of Q squared. That's called a form factor. But I'm talking here about it being on shell, so Q squared is m pi squared. Yes?
So what is the zero in the argument of JMUH?
This is the space, you know, a current is evaluated at some space-time point. And if just translation invariance would say that J dagger mu of x pi would be some e to the minus I q dot x times the thing evaluated at zero. And this is the thing that actually gets integrated. When you go from the matrix element to the cross section, this is the thing that turns into a delta function to conserve momentum energy. So this is the only possibility. And this is, it's clearly related to QCD. Because in some sense, in some hand-wavy sense, it's like the bound state wave function of the pion. We expect it to be of order lambda. Remember I said lambda approximately 200 or 300 MeV is the scale at which the strong interactions become strong. And we expect that basically all strong interaction quantities are set by this scale. The proton mass is about three times this, and we expect it to be of order lambda. Now, the next statement is that zero v mu, the vector part for this particular matrix element, is equal to zero, I claim. In this particular case, only the axial current contributes, at least to, except in order G Fermi squared. But, and I think even though, I think I'm going to actually spend a minute and prove that to you. To prove this, I have to make use of reflection invariance. And again, this is a purely strong interaction problem. I've already factored out G Fermi up there. And so now I'm just doing strong interactions to calculate the matrix element. Strong interactions are invariant under reflection. So let's see what this is. So this is, well, this is just this part is clearly has to be some constant times Q mu. I'll call it E vector. And the reason I'm not calling it F pi, et cetera, is this is actually due to the axial thing, and I'm going to show that CV is zero. But by the same argument as before, this is proportional to Q mu. Now, but this has to be the same as P minus 1 P. This is the reflection operator, V mu dagger 0 P minus 1 P times pi minus Q. So because this is the reflection operator, P minus 1 P is the identity. We know experimentally that the vacuum is reflection invariant. So P minus 1 acting on the vacuum is the vacuum. So, I know that this is a vector operator. The space component changes sign, the time component doesn't. So this has to be V mu dagger 0. If I had kept a non-trivial space-time point, I'd have to reflect that also, but that's not necessary here. P acting on pi minus Q is equal to minus, we know experimentally that the pi minus is pseudoscalar, and then it's a pi minus evaluated at Q bar, where Q is E Q, Q bar is E minus Q. Parity acting on the pion reverses its three momentum and gives you an extra intrinsic parity. So, putting that stuff together, I have the CV Q mu from the left is equal to minus 0 V mu dagger 0 pi minus of Q bar. But this is the same matrix element that I started with, except it's an upper index and it's at Q bar rather than Q. So I know this. This is minus CV Q bar mu. But Q bar mu is the same as Q mu, because these differ in their sign of their space component, not their time component. So this is minus CV Q mu. Therefore, CV is zero. And only the axial current contributes to this decay. Now that was a lengthy aside. It was not necessary for my present purposes, but I just wanted to illustrate the sort of things that are done in calculations. Often these symmetry ideas can take you very far. Yes?
Would this argument still hold if we weren't in Minkowski space? So for example, the Q mu upper bar, not necessarily the Q lower bar, we're not in Minkowski.
I'd have to think through that. That's a good exercise for you. But we are in Minkowski space, so. But I think it would probably, yeah, still go through. It's just that you don't have to really distinguish the time index then. There was another question? Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any direct arguments you can use to determine the parity of the mesons and baryons, or is it just completely experimental?
Ultimately, it's an experimental issue. If a pseudoscalar will have a wave function, actually, that's like q bar gamma 5 q, and which is a scalar would be constructed this way out of the elementary quark fields, but they could both be there in principle, and it's an experimental issue. Now, I mentioned that the pions seem to be pseudo-Goldstone bosons of a spontaneously broken chiral Faber symmetry. That actually requires pseudo-scalar, but mainly it was an empirical fact from observing different processes involving pions, that the A, strong interactions are reflection invariant, but B, the pions are pseudoscalar. Okay, let me now put that together and so therefore, one can calculate the rate and it turns out to be G Fermi squared cosine squared beta Kabibel over 8 pi F pi squared times M mu squared times m pi times 1 minus m mu squared over m pi squared all squared. This factor comes because the q mu from the matrix element contracted into the leptonic current, well, q is just the sum of the muon and neutrino momenta, and you know that p slash acting on the spinner will give you plus or minus m. So that's where you get the m mu. And it's squared. And so all this stuff comes from the matrix element squared, and this is basically phase space. And cosine theta Kabibel, known from beta decay, if we only had this, if this were our only measured process, we couldn't extract all the parameters because it depends on G Fermi times cosine theta C times F pi. But we know this independently from mu decay, and this is known independently from beta decay. So one can extract from this reaction F pi, and it's approximately 130 MeV, which, as I said, is a QCD type scale. For anybody who actually works in this area, be very careful. That f pi thing, sometimes there's an extra root 2 in the convention for that matrix element up there. And if you put a different f2, an extra root 2, then f pi in that convention changes. And I know of one very famous physicist who made a blunder by that in a very famous paper, so I'm just alerting you. Okay, one can do the same thing for pi, for the electron. So the rate for, if you just replace the muon with the electron, and by the way, I assume the neutrino mass is zero here. Even if it has a mass of an electron volt, that correction is negligible. You do the same thing for the electron, and you get the same answer except me squared here and here. So it's me squared over m mu squared times the 1 minus me squared over 1 minus m mu squared over m pi squared squared. And so this is very tiny, and that's why the pi E2 rate that looks like it's gone, or I don't see it. It's probably on the hidden board up there. Anyway, this is predicted to be about 1.24 times 10 to the minus 4, which agrees with the experiment. The smallness is because, well, in purely mathematical terms, again, the Q mu contracts into that leptonic current, which gives you a factor of the me or m mu, and you square it, and that's why it's so much smaller. The phase space is a little bit larger, so that compensates a little bit. Pictorially, it's a nice picture, why it always wants mu's rather than e's. Recall, I've stated now several times that the weak interactions want to have left-handed particles and right-handed antiparticles. So if you just look in the pion rest frame, they come out back to back, and this is the antineutrino. It wants to be right-handed. That means its spin wants to be in the same direction as its motion. The E minus or mu minus wants to be left-handed, which means its spin opposite its motion. However, we are in the rest frame of a spin zero particle, so this can't happen. It violates angular momentum. So you're forced to have a right-handed electron. And I made a point that chirality coincides with helicity only up to order mass over energy. So you can produce the wrong spin, but with an amplitude suppressed by mass over energy. And that's amplitude, so you get a mass squared in the rate. So that's sort of an explanation. That's actually not just V minus A. That would actually occur for any linear combination of vector and axial, but it's most obvious with the V minus A. Okay, are there questions? Okay, one can extend, do similar calculations for kaons, and there are the calculations very similar. There's a sine of theta Kabibol instead of cosine. You get a different kaon decay constant for the k than for the pi. For the kaon, you would expect the two decay constants to be the same in the SU3 limit, but to be broken by SU3 breaking, and they do differ by about 20%. You can go on and calculate other processes. So for example, the pion beta decay, which is a very rare process, but still very interesting. This one turns out to be only the vector current that contributes, not the axial. And but the last thing I'll say today is that, or almost the last thing, is I'll mention neutron beta decay. most beta decays are in nuclei, and that becomes a very complicated problem in nuclear physics, whether it's vector or axial vector or linear combination. Those go under names of the Fermi transitions and Gamow-Teller transitions, and it's a complicated subject. But the free neutron beta decay has been studied very precisely. And there, one needs, of course, the matrix element P gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 n. And I'm sorry, u bar gamma mu. So. And again, both vector and axial vector contribute here. And there are actually six terms you can write. This has to transform as a Lorentz vector. And you have two four momenta available here. But you can also construct Lorentz vectors involving the gamma matrices. And so there's actually six terms that you can write down. And then one can show that the vector part gives three of the terms, and the axial part gives three of the terms. Most of those are irrelevant for almost all purposes. And all that really matters at low energy, most of those terms vanish at low energies. And all that really matters very much at low energies are two terms. And basically, u bar for the proton, gamma mu, gv minus ga gamma 5 u for the neutron times cosine of the, there's a cosine of the Kvibo angle, of course. If these were point particles and there were no strong interactions, then gv and ga would be 1. Yes. But they are renormalized by strong interaction corrections, because once again, these are bound states of quarks, and so it's like wave function effects. One can use the isospin, which remember is a 1% good symmetry of the strong interactions. One can show that this implies that GV is 1, or would be 1 if isospin were exact. I'm not going to go through the demonstration. It's not too hard, but I'm not going to go through it. But the basic statement is that the mere fact that the strong interactions are invariant under isospin allows you to prove that GV is 1. It's a little bit like the proof that if electric charge is conserved and electromagnetism is good, then an atom consisting of a uranium atom with the same number of electrons and protons is electrically neutral. I mean, you might a priori think, oh, that's a complicated question of wave functions or something. But you know that that the total charge is 0, just on general principles. That's very much like here. And it's associated with the fact that u bar gamma mu d is the Noether current for isospin, which is conserved, and that's enough to show this. Now, isospin's not quite exact symmetry of nature. It's broken at 1%, but one can actually show that the corrections to this are second order in isospin breaking. That's called the Adamato-Gatto theorem, if anybody's interested. So the correction should be of order 10 to the minus 4. And so to some excellent approximation, one can take GV of 1. Now, in some processes, those corrections are important because the precision is so great and people worked very hard to calculate them. GA, on the other hand, there's nothing to really protect the GA from renormalization away from 1. One can estimate the correction using the extension of isospin to a chiral symmetry, but it doesn't have to be close to 1. And experimentally, GA is about 1.23. So it's renormalized, but not enormously. And there's a pretty good theoretical understanding of this, something called the Adler-Weisberger relation. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say. I mean, one could spend a whole semester talking about different weak processes, et cetera, and how to calculate them, but I think this gives at least a little bit of a flavor of the subject. Now, the last thing, really the last thing I want to say now is just an extension of this idea to charm. As of now, what I've written so far, I have 4 leptons, E minus, nu E, nu minus, nu mu. Let's forget about the third family. And I've got 3 quarks, up, down, and strange. So there was a major sort of asymmetry in their description. 1 U bar D prime current, and then 2 leptonic currents. Well, the charm hypothesis basically extended this idea so that the hadronic current would be U bar C bar. This is a heavy quark similar to the up, and gamma mu 1 minus gamma 5 times V Kabibel. This is a 2x2 rotation matrix, DS, where this Kabibel matrix is just the rotation. So clearly, one term is the one I already wrote, and the other one is the one that connects this charm quark to the orthogonal combination. And this is a rotation. It's a unitary matrix. It restores, in some sense, the symmetry. It's basically of the form U bar D prime plus C bar S prime. I'm not writing all the gamma mu's, et cetera, but it puts it in a form exactly similar to the lepton. So it restores the quark lepton universality in a very manifest way. The charm quark was not introduced just for this purpose. It turns out its introduction solved some other problems when the standard model was introduced of Faber strangeness changing neutral currents. And it was predicted, its mass was predicted to be about 1.5 GeV, and then it was discovered. And I'll come back to that probably on Monday or so. One can extend all these things to 3 families. With 3 families, one would have U bar, C bar, T bar, DSB, and a 3x3 matrix. That 3x3 matrix actually has a phase in it and could be the source of CP violation. But again, I'm getting ahead of myself. That will be next week. Okay, are there any final questions? Okay, tomorrow I'll start then by talking about, I'll start talking about the real SU2 cross U1 model, the modern theory of weak interactions.